I'm here with Alexander Mercurs, editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, we have been covering the Duma chemical weapons hoax from the very beginning. Even before we had the channel up and running, we were writing articles for theduran.com. We were posting articles which recognized that this was a hoax from the get-go. Since then, and since we've had this channel, we've done multiple videos where we've outlined in detail that what happened in Duma was a hoax. The most recent ones revolved around some of the leaks out of the OPCW via WikiLeaks, which showed that there were many people working at the OPCW who had their information that revealed it was a hoax suppressed by their superiors. And you had the privilege of attending an event in London, the House of Commons presentation of OPCW leaks at Duma, and you have some very interesting information that you would like to share with our viewers with relations to the OPCW and the Duma chemical weapons hoax that happened in Syria. So Alexander, the floor is yours.
Yes, indeed. And I have to say, I was hugely privileged to be at this event. And it was enormously interesting and very fascinating and extremely disturbing at the same time. And as you rightly said, it took place in the House of Commons in the Thatcher Room at Portcullis House. And there was an extraordinarily impressive lineup of people who were speaking. Now, it was chaired by Major General John Holmes, who is a former officer, a senior officer in the British Royal Marines and a Special Forces officer. But amongst the speakers were Dr. Piers Robinson, who is the co-director of the Organization for Propaganda Studies and convener of the Working Group on Syria Propaganda and Media. Then there was also Professor David Miller, who's a professor of political sociology at the University of Bristol. And there was also a very impressive presentation, detailed presentation by Professor Paul McKeague, who is professor of epidemiology at the University of Edinburgh. And also a very important presentation by Jonathan Steele, who is now an independent journalist, but who was for many years the chief foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Now, this presentation took place directly after a session in New York of the United Nations Security Council. This was an informal session which heard from one of the OPCW inspectors who went to Duma, Ian Henderson, who was the inspector who drafted the engineering report about the supposed canisters that supposedly contained the chlorine gas, which had supposedly been at the heart of this incident in Duma. And this was obviously touched upon at the meeting that I went, and the way in which Ian Henderson explained about how concerned he was that the OPCW had suppressed his report, and about how other inspectors were also concerned about how their report was, their findings were suppressed. Now, can I also say that we should fairly soon have a detailed written account of this meeting, which is in the process of being agreed, the meeting which I attended, and it will be appearing soon on our website, so that if you want to know exactly what was said there, you can actually go to that report, and that will give you an accurate record. Now, can I tell you my major takeaways from it? Because as I said, I found it profoundly shocking. Can I first of all deal with Professor McKeague's evidence, which I think in some ways was the most disturbing of all, which is that it's quite clear that the position, the canisters which fell, actually this is both Professor Miller and Professor McKeague. We're talking about the canisters. There's two canisters that are supposed to have been the cause of the entire problem. They both went into the ballistics, the details of how the canisters are supposed to have fallen. One of them, finding its way onto a bed. The bed is intact. The canisters are intact. they explained in great detail how the actual inspectors who went to Douma looked at these canisters, examined the areas around the buildings, everything, and concluded that it was impossible for those canisters to have fallen in the way that was being alleged. When I say impossible, I mean, you know, technically, it just could, they couldn't find any mechanism whereby such a thing could have happened naturally. So that can only leave the solution for the position of the canisters being where it was, that they were manually placed there. And we were also shown photographs of the canisters, and there was clear evidence that during the period of time just before the canisters were inspected, even after the first photographs were taken, but before the inspectors arrived, there were manipulations of the scene. One of the canisters was turned over, turned upside down, or turned over to make it seem more plausible that it had fallen in the way that was being alleged. But you actually had clear manipulation of the crime scene. And even more remarkable, as I said, was the evidence about the injuries, because happened was that in one of these buildings where there were these canisters, what I hadn't realized is that the corridors of these buildings and the stairwell were filled with dead bodies. Now, these dead bodies are supposed to be the victims of this chemical attack, but it seems that there was no actual autopsies done on these bodies, so it's not clear what caused these people to die. But a number of things were explained to us. Firstly, that it is impossible that so many people could have died. There's about 30, we're talking about around 30 to 40 people. So many people could have died so quickly in such a short time from chlorine. The amount of chlorine you would need to kill people in that number, at that speed, is many, many multiples the amount of chlorine that those two canisters could have contained. That is the first thing. The second thing is the positioning of those bodies is inconsistent with people dying from chlorine. If chlorine gas is falling, apparently people try to run away and escape from it. They don't just fall over and die like the way that they were appeared to have died in this building. So that is also inconsistent with those bodies having died, those people having died in that kind of a way. But you know, the most damning thing for me, and in some ways the most troubling, is that the inspectors, the people who went there, and other people, researchers who've looked at this, they said that the symptoms of these people, the sort of frothing that was seen around their mouths and things of this kind, are simply inconsistent with chlorine poisoning, at least chlorine poisoning on the scale that is alleged. It would be consistent with sarin poisoning, might be consistent with sarin poisoning, but it is not consistent with chlorine poisoning. And this does two things. This opens up two things. Firstly, this combination of evidence shows that it couldn't have been chlorine that killed these people. But secondly, we know from the inspectors who went to the scene that there was no actual traces of sarin in the environment. So that begs the question of how did these people die? Now, we have no actual evidence. There's no actual information about how they died because the investigation is incomplete. But one possibility, and it does seem to be the most plausible one, is that they must have been taken to a chamber and gassed with sarin. That seems to be the most logical thing. And after they were killed in that way, their bodies were removed from the chamber and placed where they were in order to stage what looks like it was intended to be a sarin attack. Now, that is a pretty monstrous conclusion. I mean, as several people pointed out, if that is true, and as I said, it's the only result that seems to be consistent with the known facts, then we're talking about an extremely serious war crime having been committed in Douma by whoever it was who was trying to stage this this incident and make it look like a sarin attack.
The moderate rebels, the white helmets, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra. I mean, tell us who. In your analysis, who were the people that staged this? I remember many videos by the White Helmets, which showed the White Helmets training by moving bodies around. Yes. Everyone that's viewing this video right now, I'm sure I've seen these videos on the web. Yeah. They came out about a year and a half ago, where the White Helmets are running drills, where they're carrying bodies, moving them around. The scenario that you're describing, which is a huge bombshell scenario, runs consistent with much of the training videos that we saw of the White Helmets, who we also know were deeply embedded with Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra. They were one and the same, pretty much.
Yes.
So, I mean, who are these people that planted this evidence? Suffice to say,
the area, Douma, was under the control of a violent jihadi militant group called Jaish al-Islam, which is ideologically connected to Al-Nusra, which is ideologically part of Al-Qaeda. So, you know, that connects that group. And they must have been involved at some level. And the White Helmets were also there. And it was the White Helmets, or elements within the White Helmets, that were reporting that there was a chemical attack in Douma.
The Oscar award-winning White Helmets, the Netflix documentary White Helmets.
Now, can I just say, I mean, these are suppositions. We're joining up the dots. There has to be there ought to be a proper criminal investigation to find out exactly what did happen. But, you know, I'm going to say it simply. They must be important suspects, prime suspects, if you like. I say no more than that. Anyway, so that shocked a lot of people in the audience. And I will say there were MPs in the audience, members of parliament. One of them asked a question, a very, very searching question. They are now aware of this. And when this report gets circulated, the one I'm talking about, people will be able to read in that report all the scientific evidence that's laid out there in much more detail and far more thoroughly and much more, by the actual experts than I can do. Because, of course, I repeat, I'm not a scientist.
Can I summarize it one more time just to make sure I understand what you heard at this event, Alexander?
Yeah.
In other words, the White Helmets, Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, all these groups who at the time were controlling Douma.
Yes.
Is that correct? They were at the time controlling Douma.
They were controlling Douma.
Most likely.
Yes.
Most likely took canisters that supposedly were filled with chlorine. They placed them.
Yes.
Two canisters, they placed them in these positions. And we've seen photos as well of the canister on the bed. That's a pretty well-known photo of that canister that sits there on the bed.
Yes.
They placed them there, so they planted that evidence. And then somewhere in the past, they had gassed people with sarin and moved those bodies and planted them in a position as well to stage this entire Douma hoax, which almost led to a direct war between the United States and Syria, i.e. Russia, as well. Is this correct, what I've just summarized?
That is the essence of it, but I must make two particular qualifications. Firstly, it's not clear to me that there was any actual chlorine in the canisters, and presumably the intention anyway was to make out that those canisters had, you know, was carrying sarin rather than chlorine. That's the first thing to say. The other thing is that I heard quite a lot of evidence about the fact that those bodies, the people who were dead there, were killed very, very short time before their bodies were placed where they were. And there's apparently good ways of assessing how recently those people were killed. And in fact, it would have been within a few hours. So this whole thing was staged, if it was staged, which it seems it must have been, at extraordinary speed. A lot of things, you know, the it wasn't really tied up or sorted out properly. And of course, before the staging was complete, the Jihadist Islam pulled out. The place was flooded with the Syrian army and Russian military police. And there were references to the important role the Russian military police played in securing the crime scene. So they were the people who were staging this incident weren't able to complete the staging in the way that they had intended. So, it extremely disturbing. Now, so that's the incident itself. There were also a lot of things that then became clear about the OPCW investigation. Now, it seems what happened is that there was a long explanation in response to a question I asked, by the way, about how the Convention for Chemical Weapons is, you know, works, and how the OPCW is supposed to carry out investigations. And it turned out that the OPCW has already, even before Duma, made massive changes, bad changes, I should say, to the way in which investigations are supposed to be carried out. And we now have this, a special group, the FFM, as it's called, which is supposed to go and carry out the on-the-spot investigation, which is a somewhat variant from the way it should be done as set out in the convention. But never mind. These people were then, you know, the inspectors, the FFM, by the OPCW, was sent to Duma, and they carried out their researches there. And these people then started to report back to OPCW headquarters their findings, that they couldn't find any trace of sarin, that there wasn't anywhere near enough chlorine around. In fact, there was a lot of controversy about the chlorine, because the chlorine traces were very small, and the OPCW inspectors who went to Duma were very unhappy about the fact that even the OPCW's interim report mentioned chlorine at all, because they were basically just, you know, normal trace elements such as you'd find in an urban setting. Anyway, these people were reporting back no evidence, you know, that there was actually a chemical attack, but we do have clear evidence that there was staging, you know, the positioning of the canisters. And there were all these very disturbing reports about these dead bodies. Now, can I say the inspectors did not say these dead bodies had been murdered and this whole thing had been fabricated in that way. These are deductions that other people have made looking at the evidence that the inspectors were finding. But before the inspectors were able to complete their investigations, they were then basically taken off the entire investigation. An entirely new group of people were appointed to draw up the final report, the final OPCW report. This new group of people never went to Duma. They carried out all their work from a country that is referred to in as Country X, but which everybody apparently knows is Turkey. And they based their evidence, or they based their findings on, you won't be surprised when I tell you, information that was given to them by witnesses, the witnesses being the White Helmets and the people that the White Helmets found. And that was it was the findings of the second group that never went to Duma that are in fact what you basically see in the OPCW final report. So the people who were actually in Douma are incredibly unhappy. They've been, most of them are, well, all of them are staunchly loyal to the OPCW and to the convention. They're not people who are in any way, you know, difficult people, aggrieved people. They just feel that their work has not been acknowledged, that it's not been reported properly, and that the findings in the final report, the one that the OPCW has published, are simply incompatible with what they themselves found when they went to Douma. Now, I'm going to make one quick observation. I know there's all sorts of people, Bellingcat, of course, is one, that he's criticizing some of the work of these inspectors. It's saying, you know, that they made mistakes, that they didn't understand what was going on and all this sort of thing. Firstly, just look at the qualifications of these people. Now, we don't know who all of these people are. They've not been, you know, individually named and identified, but they were people entrusted by the OPCW to go to Douma. And we know about one of them, who is Ian Henderson, who came to the UN Security Council, and he is beyond any doubt whatsoever a highly qualified person in this field. So they had that technical expertise to make a proper assessment of the crime scene. And they visited the crime scene. They were actually there. They were able to do the forensic tests on the crime scene. All of these people, Bellingcat, Brian Whitaker, all of these people who are criticizing them, firstly, I don't think they have remotely the kind of qualifications, the kind of technical qualifications that these people have. But over and above and beyond that, those inspectors went to the crime scene, their critics did not. And that, it seems to me, is an absolutely critical and fundamental difference. So I've tried to summarize what I heard at this meeting. I want to touch on what Jonathan Steele said quickly also. But, you know, before I get on to Jonathan Steele, I should say that is the technical evidence that I heard. It's extremely disturbing. And for those who say it is inconceivable that, you know, 30 to 40 people could have been brutally murdered in such a way as to stage an incident like this, Major General Holmes, who is a experienced military officer who has been in combat and who knows the face of war, pointed out that in civil wars, and of course, the Syrian war is not just a civil war, but a ferocious sectarian war involving groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, such things are entirely possible.
Before you get on to Steele, Alexander, the critics are also not funded. The critics are funded, sorry, by groups like the Atlantic Council, NATO, neocons, etc. So whenever they criticize people like Henderson, everyone should know that these groups get their funding from the warmonger elitist globalist class. Anyway,
that's absolutely true. And I think it repays saying. I mean, the critics are self-interested critics. I mean, they have a financial interest, but of course they're also heavily invested. Many of them have built up reputations now around the view there, you know, the interpretation of the Syrian war that they have been peddling now for several years. So we have to bear all that in mind. Whereas these inspectors who went to Douma, who carried out an on-the-spot inspection of the crime scene, are genuine independent people. Now, Jonathan Steele, for those who don't know him, is an absolute legend in British journalism. He was, for many years, in my opinion, the finest foreign correspondent that was in the British media. He covered the crisis in the Soviet Union, which led to the Soviet Union's collapse, and he did it superbly. This is one of the most experienced journalists around. Now, he was contacted and has provided an explanation of how he was contacted, and he eventually, you know, by people who were telling him there's all this information coming out of the OPCW. And he went to Brussels and he heard this apparently masterly presentation that was made by one of the OPCW inspectors who went to Duma, and it, you know, provided, you know, it was PowerPoints and all kind and internal emails, all sorts of things that explained exactly what went wrong and how it went wrong. And, you know, Jonathan Steele was profoundly shocked by it all and wanted to write a story about this. And of course, initially he turned to The Guardian, which is his former newspaper, and he found that he couldn't get it published there. And he went to all sorts of other places and he was told things, you know, we can't publish this because it's either Russian propaganda or it conforms with Russian interests. And he said, you know, he's saying, well, even if it conforms with Russian interests and Russian narratives, the fact is, if what these inspectors are saying is true, the fact that it might be conforming with Russian interests is not a reason not to publish it. Now, you know, that is ethical journalism. That's the point he was making. And yet he came up against this wall of refusal. And I would add, by the way, I understand that several people again said, you know, well, Bellingcat is insisting on a different narrative. I mean, one of the very, very troubling things about this is that this extraordinary authority that Bellingcat seems to have, which enables it basically to ensure that people who attempt to question the, if you like, the official narrative, don't get heard, which seems to be extraordinary, given that Bellingcat is ultimately only an opinion body. I mean, they're all that they can ever report is their own opinions. And again, I reiterate, they didn't go to Duma. So they weren't there. They weren't on the crime scene. They aren't reporting. Their reporting cannot, by definition, have the kind of authority that a team of professional trained inspectors has, which actually went to Duma. It's a vital point people consistently overlook. Anyway, eventually, after a great deal of trouble, Jonathan Steele found one outlet that published him, and that was Counterpunch. And you can find his story there. And after Counterpunch published it, it was circulated to a certain extent, largely, though, amongst alternative news sites. In Britain, only three mainstream journalists have reported the story. One is Jonathan Steele himself, obviously, and he's been able to talk about it in places like the BBC. Another is Robert Fisk, who is one of the leading journalists on the Middle East and who's written a very, very powerful piece about it in The Independent. But the absolute runaway star.
Who also went to the site, by the way.
Who also went to the site, indeed. And in fact, even before the inspectors, he was actually there and he actually spoke to witnesses who also told him there was no chemical attack. But, you know, apart from, and the third, who is in fact the absolute star, is Peter Hitchens in the Daily Mail, who has covered the story brilliantly and is now becoming extremely concerned about the way in which this story is not being published or covered properly by the rest of the media. And in fact, Peter Hitchens has recently written, as has Ambassador Craig Murray, by the way, that it makes one wonder whether if there was an Iraq war, if the Iraq war had happened now, the fact that no weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq would ever have been published. We'd ever know about it in the mainstream media, because the degree of control of this story is so extraordinary. I'm going to make a comment here, by the way. In Britain, the degree of silence is so extreme that I personally think that there has been a direct order made from Whitehall, from the civil service, saying that the media mustn't cover this story for some reason. That's my own view, because I can't believe that editors, would be so monolithic that even tabloid newspapers wouldn't be publishing.
So some reason, what reason?
Well, because the way in which the British government is able to communicate to newspapers, this is consistent with that. We have this denotice system in Britain, in which the British government is able to alert newspapers and say to them, there's a story that impinges on national policy, and we don't want you to cover it.
What national policy, though? What's the reason that the UK is supporting Al Qaeda?
Well,
is that the reason? I mean, I don't know.
I don't know what reason they are giving, and I'm not here to protect the British government. All I am saying is that I don't believe that such a blanket wall of media silence would be possible without a direct order from Whitehall. I might be wrong about that, but that's my view.
Why would the British government not want the truth to come out?
Well, I will give a reason, and I think this is probably the right one, that the British government joined in the missile attack directly after the Douma incident and before the investigation took place. In fact, I actually posed a question to the panel in which I said, it met with universal agreement. Nobody actually said anything. But after the meeting, various people came up to me and said commented about my, it wasn't a question, it was a point, and how right it was, in which I said, point I've made many times, that, if you act in that way, if you launch a missile strike on a country based on what you say is classified intelligence be almost by definition incomplete, then you are you're prejudicing any future investigation by putting enormous pressure on the investigators. Theresa May did this over the Skripal attack in Salisbury when she stood up in the House of Commons and said, before the police investigation had got underway properly, that it was the Russians who did it. And she did this over the Douma incident also. So if it turns out that there was no chemical attack in Douma and this incident was entirely staged, which I have to say, based on everything I heard at this meeting, must be the case. I mean, I can't really see any other explanation. Then, of course, Theresa May launched a missile attack on another country on basis of false information, said untrue things to the British people to justify that attack. And of course, launching an attack on another country is aggression if it's done without proper cause, which is a war crime.
Because Theresa May wanted to prop up
the
moderate rebels.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Al-Qaeda al Nusra to overthrow the Assad government. At the end of the day, that was her agenda above and beyond everything else.
Well, obviously, yes. But if you want me to give a reason why the British government is so sensitive about this and is keeping this story out of the media, as I think it is, I mean, I don't know this for a fact. I mean, nobody in Whitehall tells me whether there's a denotice out or not. But that, I think, is the reason why they would be doing it, if they are doing it.
Well, this is a huge story that no one's reporting in the U.S. either. I don't know, some of our viewers in other countries as well, Canada, yeah, Australia, wherever you're located.
Yes.
I doubt this story is getting much traction anywhere.
Well, indeed. Well, I come back to what Peter Hitchens says. If Iraq happened now, would we be reading in our media or hearing in our media that no weapons of mass destruction were found there? Craig Murray has said the same thing. In fact, in fairness, I think it was Craig Murray who said it first.
All right. Any other closing comments, Alexander,
yes,
on what I think is astonishing? account of what happened?
One very brief one, which is the Tariq Haddad, who was the Newsweek journalist who tried to publish the story at Newsweek and who resigned and was basically forced out because he tried to cover it. He was also at this meeting. We exchanged words. We had much to tell me, and I salute a brave man.
What was the, like?
Well, I mean, he suffered. His career, basically. He's journalist.
Because he wanted to publish a story.
He wanted to publish a story.
In Newsweek.
In Newsweek. But again, as a proper ethical journalist, he felt that he had to cover it. And bear in mind that he's from Jordan. So he knows Syria, which, of course, people in Newsweek don't know Syria. He understands the situation in Syria very well. So, you know, that would have already made him suspicious, I think, of many of the elements of this story. So, by the way, just to make clear, he's a Jordanian. He is not a Palestinian. He made that very clear to me, and there is a distinction. So he knows Syria well, and he wanted to publish this story. He's very concerned about the way in which the public are being misinformed. He was basically forced off Newsweek. He's been subjected to all kinds of attacks, and it's going to be very difficult for him from now on. But you know, I just wanted to say that he has our support in what he's done.
I really wish this account that you've given, Alexander, finds its way to people like Tucker Carlson.
Well, I hope so.
That's the only name I can think of at this moment in time in the mainstream media that would dare to report on what you have just told all our viewers.
And can I also remind our viewers that we will very shortly be publishing the actual written record of what was said at this meeting. And it didn't happen, you know, in some little hall somewhere in, you know, provincial England. It happened in the premises of the House of Commons.
UK mainstream media would report on this, in your opinion?
Well, the one person who is reporting on it is Peter Hitchens, and he's not an insignificant voice. Robert Fisk also.
And anyone else that comes to mind?
Patrick Coburn, possibly. Apart from those three, no one.
No, all right.
But Patrick Coburn tends to focus on Iraq. Robert Fisk is the person who deals with Syria, and he's covered it well.
Okay, I think One American Network also covered it well in the United States. They're gaining traction as a channel, as a cable channel, but they're much smaller than the Fox News.
Yes.
MSNBC, CNN.
Well,
they may be bigger than CNN at this point. Who knows?
Well, quite possibly. Well, I hope I provided people with a clear summary, my own understanding of what was said there. All I will say is I left that meeting profoundly shocked by what I heard.
No, it's absolutely shocking what you've just told us. Absolutely shocking. I mean, we knew it was a hoax. We've reported that it was a hoax.
Yes.
But to this extent and to this just evil.
Yes, yes.
Just evil.
Well, indeed.
All these guys.
Can I just say what I think ought to be done? I think inspectors should be sent back to Douma, and they should try and find those bodies of those people who died, because this is the extraordinary thing. There was never any proper autopsy done. I believe even
on purpose.
Well, of course not. Absolutely on purpose. They were pulled before that could be done. But if those people have traces of sarin, and I believe you can, I mean, sarin does deteriorate, but I read somewhere, I mean, I may be wrong, I'm not a scientist, but I believe that, you know, you can find residues, not of sarin itself, but of, you know, things that it changes in a body. If it's found that they did die from sarin poisoning, then given that there was no sarin in the area, that will conclusively prove all the things we've been saying on this program about how it was staged, and not just on this program, of course, but in earlier programs and in articles that we've been writing. But it, you know, it would then become impossible to deny that was the case.
Yeah, I think at this moment in time, it's pretty much impossible to deny.
I think
it's a complete hoax that the OPCW is corrupted beyond repair.
Well, indeed, sir. Well, actually, and that was another thing, a lot of the people at this meeting were expressing great concern about the OPCW. And Major General Holmes, who, as I said, has been who's a British soldier who's fought in the field and commanded troops in combat. I mean, one of the points that he made was that chemical weapons are these incredibly dangerous weapons, and we need the Chemical Weapons Convention to work properly, and we need a proper organization like the OPCW to police it. Now, I should say those comments were made not in the meeting itself, but, you know, on its sort of outskirts. But I don't think I'm misrepresenting what he said. In fact, I'm saying it exactly as he said it.
All right, Alexander McCurse, Editor-in-Chief of the Durant, thank you very much. Guys, if you like this video, click on the subscribe button down below. Click on that notifications bell, smash that like. Please donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, and Subscribestar. And check out this video on BitChute.com. We post all our videos on BitChute, so look for us there as well. And look for us on the Durant Shop. Pick up some magic mugs, pick up some shirts. It really helps out this channel.
It certainly does. Now, you know, we go out so many times on a limb to cover programs like this, and we depend very much on the support of our viewers to do this. And Alex has talked about, you know, the problems that we have on previous occasions getting out stories. So it's important to us that we do get your support. And one of the ways you can support us is by helping us through our shop. But having said that, you know, we do have good things in our shop. We're not asking you to buy, you know, any old rubbish. We're asking you to buy our really fantastic and fine things, like our famous magic mugs. You can see this there. And we've made a point, we just as we try to do really quality analysis and reporting, we set out to do very high products on our shop, in our merchandise. And you can, our mugs, for example, which we've talked about often, are of the highest standard. Alex found a really top quality supplier. They're beautifully made. They're incredibly light and strong. They don't crack or chip. They don't discolor. I've had this mug now, which is the Durant mug with our own double-headed eagle for around a year, and you'll see that it's in perfect shape. So they're about the best mugs you can find. And the same applies to all our other products, to our shirts, like the Durant polo shirt that I'm wearing now, which also has our double-headed eagle logo there. But you can also find our short-sleeve T-shirts, our long-sleeve T-shirts. You can also find hats, hoodies, stickers, all these things. So you are helping the Durant by coming to our shop and buying these things. And if you do, you're also owning some really fine and good things. We make a point to make sure that they are of high quality. So please come to our shop, support us in that way, be the proud owner of these great things, and Alex will show you how.
Just go to thedurantshop.com. You'll find a link in the description box down below. Alexander McCurse, Editor-in-Chief of The Durant, thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.